Fear by P.C. Wren. From the first moment, I disliked the bungalow intensely. Nor had this feeling anything to do with the fact that it was dirty, derelict, and tumble down. Nor again that it was lonely, isolated, and obviously long uninhabited. It was the atmosphere, aura, the spirit of the house, that was antipathetic, inimical. Even outside it, one had this feeling of an emanated antagonism. Inside, the feeling deepened, and one seemed conscious almost of warning, and then of danger, and finally, of threat. I was reminded of that remarkable and haunting line which, once he has read it, occasionally returns to the mind of the traveller in little visited and out-of-the-way corners of the earth. The place was silent and aware. Certainly, this place was silent, and undoubtedly one had an uneasy feeling of its awareness, of being watched, of being expected and unwelcome. Not watched by human eyes, but by the place itself. It was an old and old-fashioned rest house, built on tiangs, strong square pillars, some 12 feet in height, of merbau wood, that hard red wood which is proof against the attack of insects, including even the white ant. Mounting the flight of steps that led up to the platform on which the house was built, and entering the big central room, the thought immediately entered my mind that rest house was a misnomer. I felt quite certain that whatever else I got here, I should get little rest. One had frequently been in places which gave the impression that the genius loci was inimical. One had been conscious of the feeling, both in buildings made by hands and in places but rarely trodden by human foot, in certain swamps, canyons, dark forests, caves, and sun-blasted or wind-harried desert places. I have had this feeling strongly when spending a dark and lonely night in Angkor Wat, and again in the brilliant sunlight of a beautiful morning on top of the hill called Doi Wang Lek, a hill situated near Lampuan, some 30 miles from Chiang Mai, in the direction of Lampang in Siam. Doi Wang Lek means the hill which is the place of evil spirits, a fact of which I was unaware, or at any rate did not realize, until I had left it. But standing on top of the hill which I had climbed in order to admire a view of the Lampang plain and the distant hills, I was suddenly conscious of an uneasiness, which was but little removed from fear. What caused the uneasiness, and of what I should be afraid, when mental discomfort and apprehensiveness deepened into fear, I had not the slightest idea. It had nothing to do with the fact that practically every tree looked as though it had been struck by lightning, which certainly was not the case. It was not that I heard any of those sounds which, in certain places, are perturbing, if not startling. It was not because the trees seemed to have been deserted by both birds and gibbons, in spite of the fact that all the surrounding jungle was alive with the gibbons. Little spidery, long-armed, long-legged monkeys whose bewhiskered faces are so friendly and amusing, and whose call is musical yet so mournful. But the house. I am not psychic. I am not a nervous person, nor sensitive. I am not fanciful, superstitious, nor suggestible. But, like everybody else who is not an absolute clod, I have a sense of atmosphere, whether it be social or local, and never in my life have I been so quickly or so strongly aware of an eerie and minatory atmosphere, as in this abandoned rest house. Had it been possible, I would have marched on, and left it to its loneliness and gloom. For I felt it was haunted, tragic, and evil. However, I had no choice. Here I was, and here for a period I must remain, for however unpleasant the place might be, to flee from it and return, the object of my journey unaccomplished, would have been more so. I should have felt ashamed of myself, also ridiculous, for how could I possibly explain that I had found the place, according to directions given me by kindly hosts in Hualongse, had not entered into possession, but had simply fled, frightened away. It seemed to me that my coolies disliked the place almost as much as I did, for with unwonted rapidity they unpacked the hat, the big baskets made of woven bamboo, which hang at either end of a pole balanced over the shoulder, and in which one's food, clothes, and other chattels are transported in that part of the world. Nor did my jungle boy appear disposed to linger, when once he had set up my camp bed and served my dinner, a remarkably well-cooked and satisfying meal, consisting principally of a stew of tinned meat, rice, alleged mushrooms, bamboo shoots, dough dumplings, chilies, and unidentifiable odds and ends. In view of the fact that my cook had, so far as I knew, neither materials nor apparatus for cooking, the effort was beyond praise. Having dined, I carried my collapsible chair out onto the veranda, lit a cigarette, and told myself not to be a fool, for I felt more uncomfortable, more lonely, more apprehensive never before in all my life. From where I sat, the moonlit jungle looked beautiful, but unfriendly, threatening, and the danger implicit in the threat was not from the leopard or the tiger. Generally speaking, this was one of the best hours of the day. The march completed, dinner eaten, and a pleasant tiredness enhancing the flavour of tobacco and the enjoyment of a book. A good hour for the review of the events of the day, the making of plans for the morrow, an appreciation of one's good fortune in being far from the madding crowd, and the din of an increasingly clamorous civilization. The ocean, the desert, and the jungle are the last strongholds and resorts of peace. But here, there was no peace. Silence, so far as the jungle is ever silent. Utter stillness, but no peace of mind. Decidedly, this was a bad place, or else I was going to be ill. It must be that. Fever, liver, and yet until I came within sight of this derelict house, I had been in perfect health. I had better go to bed. Re-entering the big central room, on either side of which were two bedrooms, I turned up the wick of the lamp that hung from a roof beam, and took stock of the place. What immediately caught my attention and gave me a slight shock of surprise was the fact that, across one corner of the room, was a piano. Now, I have had perhaps unusually wide experience of rest houses, dak bungalows, pangs, and such buildings, provided for the shelter of the casual traveller in India, Ceylon, Burma, Siam, Malaya, Annam, Cambodia, and certain parts of Africa and China. But never yet have I discovered one provided with a piano. I have known them to be well-fitted, well-kept houses, with one or more resident servants, and I have known them to be dirty, derelict huts, with one or more resident reptiles, poisonous, domiciled, and waiting, but never a piano. And as my eye roamed round the ill-lit room, I discovered that it differed in other respects from the usual central hall common to the use of travellers occupying the different bedrooms, should more than one traveller be occupying the rest house at the same time. Such a room generally contains a dining table and four chairs, This room was furnished. An old, neglected, tattered, dust-covered and derelict as the furniture might be, it had once been drawing-room furniture. There was what had been a handsome screen at each door. There were a sofa and armchairs. Pictures had once adorned the walls, and the cracked, dirty and insect-ridden remains still hung in their places. In a teakwood bookcase were the remains of books, now the home of the fish insect, the ant, the cockroach, and the rat. In a corner was a standard lamp, about whose glass chimney and globe still hung the tattered remnants of a silk shade. And beneath my feet was a matting of a very different quality from that of the usual plaited palm leaf to be found in the ordinary traveller's rest house. This was of fine Chinese reed work, and had cost money. And incongruous in this ghost of a long-dead drawing-room stood a bed. Beside it, my jungle boy had set up my own folding camp bed, which looked neat, clean, and positively attractive beside the much bigger one, once comparatively sumptuous, now a dubious-looking mass of discoloured, dust-covered silk and grimy linen. Here and there a gleam of colour showed through dust which lay so thickly as to amount almost to a covering of earth or ash. Part of this, of course, would be the settling dust of years, part a precipitate of fine bamboo and other wood sawdust that had rained down upon it from the roof and rafters above, as the boring insects proceeded with their uninterrupted labours of destruction. A truly dreadful room, suggesting to my mind an aged crone dressed in finery that she had worn for 50 years. A hag, evil and malignant, foul and filthy, yet not only alive but retaining beneath the dirt of ages faint rare glimpses of a former finery. But why sleep in this drawing-room of a nightmare, when there were apparently 4 bedrooms opening from this central room? On a bedside table. Who last had used that bedside table, and had it been a man or a woman? I saw that my boy had placed my Hitchcock lamp, one of those invaluable pieces of camp furniture, which, needing neither chimney nor globe, gives an excellent, if fierce, light, and whose loud and insistent ticking is something that soothes or maddens the nerves of the lonely listener, according to the state of his mind, or more probably, of his liver. Picking it up, I lit it and opened the nearest door. In this room were 2 beds, a leg rest chair, and a dressing table with mirror. The room was in some disorder, and was evidently exactly as it had been left by its last occupants, when hurriedly they departed. Returning to the drawing-room and closing the door behind me, I entered the other room on the same side, and discovered similar conditions. This also was a double bedroom, or at any rate a room last occupied by 2 people, the almost mouldering remains of a tumbled bedding, and suggestions of hurried departure, if not sudden flight. And similarly, in the case of the 2 other bedrooms. 8 guests, and a 9th person, the host, who had slept in the drawing-room that fatal night, had fled in haste, leaving everything as it stood. Having made my tour of inspection, I sat down in a spacious armchair and almost went through it to the floor. For one hideous moment of imprisonment, I struggled in a position of great indignity and extreme discomfort until I contrived to extricate myself from what was really a very neat trap. Good heavens, thought I, as at length, breathless, I got to my feet and surveyed the now bottomless chair. I might have been stuck there till I died, the idiotic thought being in keeping with my frame of mind and my environment. For I should hardly have died before morning. when my boy and the coolies would have come. On the other hand, in that horrible position, with my knees firmly pressed against my chest, I might very well have died of suffocation, heart failure, or of a broken blood vessel. And once again, what rubbish, when my heart was as strong as that of a horse, and my arteries as soft as India rubber. And yet fear, horror, and despair are not ridiculous. And for a few seconds, while firmly wedged into that malevolent-seeming chair, endowed with devilish intention, I had been frightened, horrified, and despairing of ever escaping from the trap. However, fear had its usual reaction, anger, and I felt thoroughly and savagely annoyed. A much healthier mental state. I would undress and go to bed, and the devil and all his imps could play any game they fancied in, around, above, and below the bungalow, and I would not so much as open an eye and cast a glance at them. So I thought, or at any rate, so I told myself, and, raising the mosquito curtain, got into bed, tucked the edge of the curtain in, turned the light down very low, closed my eyes, and composed myself for sleep. Suddenly, something creaked very loudly. I opened my eyes and sat up. The sleep fled farther from me than ever. Oh, this wouldn't do. If I were going to jump up like that every time there was a creak, I should spend a restless night. But this had been no ordinary creak, and lest it should seem strange and unreasonable that one should differentiate between one creak and another, I will mention that the sound was precisely that which I myself had made in walking across the wooden floor. As I have said, the bungalow was supported upon tiangs, great posts which raised it some 12 feet above the ground, and the floor was of boards, one or two of which, probably owing to shrinkage in dry weather, after being swollen during the rains, creaked quite audibly when trodden on, somewhat as do the stairs in all old houses. I was perfectly certain that someone, probably a barefooted native, had crossed the room. Hastily pulling out the linen border of the mosquito curtain from under the thin mattress of the camp bed, I turned up the lamp. The room was empty, of course, and as I perfectly well knew, neither my jungle boy nor any coolie would come into the room before dawn, and no dacoit would wander about in that fashion within a minute of my getting into bed. What a dacoit would do would be to creep up the steps, glide like a ghost, damn that word, ghost, across the veranda, and with a rush and a leap, drive his kriss through my throat. Or so I argued. Anyway, there was nobody in the room, nobody visible, that is to say. And again I turned down the lamp, tucked in the mosquito curtain, turned onto my right side, firmly closed my eyes, and prayed the old English prayer from bogles and bugaboos, warlocks and warricos, ghasties and ghoulies, long-leggedy beasties, and things that go whump in the night. Good Lord, deliver us. I closed my eyes, but unfortunately I could not close my ears, and the loud creak, which was obviously made by someone stepping upon one of those loose boards, again sounded through the room, sudden and sharp as the crack of a pistol. Now that was a gross exaggeration, of course. It was more like the snapping of a twig beneath the unpracticed foot in the dry jungle. The tiny resounding snap that warns the stalked prey of the approach of heavy-footed, clumsy death, of murder most foul, but self-defeated. For some reason, or for no reason, I suddenly remembered my Irish batman and his favourite formula for use on all occasions. Ah, to hell with it, then. That was the proper attitude of mind and the suitable incantation. Again, the sound of stealthy footsteps. Bosh! That was absolute boys' magazine cliché. There was no sound of footsteps, stealthy or otherwise. Only the noise of someone treading on loose boards. But surely a ghost, a spirit, a boot, a freet, peh, was imponderable, without substance, and quite incapable of depressing a walked board. It wasn't incapable of depressing me, though, and my possibly warped mind. A loud creak. As someone or something or nothing trod on another place where a board under the matting responded beneath the pressure. Hey, to hell with it. And then, almost with a shriek, I again sprang bolt upright, for a pair of giant hands, with fingers spread from end to end of the keyboard, crashed down upon the keys of the piano, bringing forth a terrific and hideous cacophony, a horrible jangling discord, discernible through which were the sounds of breaking wires. Good God, angels and ministers of grace defend us. I admit that it was with a hand decidedly inclined to tremble that I again turned up the light and saw that there was no one at the piano or in the room. But really, this would not do. This was not only beyond a joke. It was beyond all reason. Clearly and definitely, it was beyond reason that invisible hands should strike a crashing chord upon a piano. I'm sure there are brave men who would have said, tut, tut, possibly have walked to the piano, played a hymn tune, Eternal Father, Strong to Save, perhaps, and returned to bed the better for the performance. Personally, I was much more inclined to get well down under the clothes, pull them over my head, and stay there till a cold or bony hand removed them. What I did do was to sit and stare, wide-eyed and open-mouthed, while I burst into a cold sweat and tried to find rational explanation for this astonishing, and indeed in that place, at that hour, appalling phenomenon. The creaking of the loose boards I could explain away, more or less, in point of fact, very much less satisfactorily, by remembering how furniture creaks, and indeed bangs occasionally in old houses in the middle of the night. Though why the devil it should always choose the middle of the night for that exercise is something of a mystery. The boards might creak and groan without having been trodden upon by human or non-human foot. It might be their playful habit and old-established custom to wait till midnight, and then make precisely the noise they made when a heavy man stepped on them. But what about the piano? I could not remember ever previously having slept in the same room as a piano. But I was prepared to wager a very large sum that though the woodwork of an aged and neglected piano might conceivably utter a creak, or through the sudden breaking of a wire, emit a doleful jangling ping, it could not possibly produce a hellish uproar, in which a score of keys and strings were concerned. I was prepared to admit that in the lonely stillness of the most ordinary drawing room, in the most commonplace bungalow, the piano, through the slipping of a wire, might make one unmusical sound, but it was inconceivable that it should make 100 hideous, jangling noises. Cursing my cowardice, I turned the light right out. Staring into the darkness, I could see nothing. And this is not so much a statement of the obvious as it sounds, for the darkness was not complete, not that darkness as of black velvet. The night without was lit by a gibbous moon and the brilliant tropic stars, No, I could see nothing. But again, someone at the piano played a rough and violent discord. Raising my mosquito curtain, I struck a match and lit the table lamp. As I did so, I heard a heavy thud, followed by minor movements. Lifting the lamp above my head, the hand undoubtedly beginning to tremble, I looked round the room. There was nothing whatsoever to be seen, save the decrepit furniture. "Another little smoke wouldn't do us any harm," said I, aloud, to show myself how bold a fellow of yet unshaken nerve was I. Something rustled in reply. "Rats," said I. "Rats," and this can be taken as a reference to rodents, or as a derisive ejaculation, which statement made solemnly and aloud showed me that whatever I might pretend, I was nervous. I would get up, light the hanging lamp, turn the small one up, and read until daylight. No, damned if I would. With the rest of my life, I should be ashamed to look myself in the face. I finished my cigarette, turned out my lamp again, and, as a concession to human frailty and cowardice, took the matches into bed with me, tucked in the mosquito curtain, and composed myself to slumber. Never yet have I found any of the devices advocated for sleep inducement of the slightest effect or value. Speaking for myself, the only thing is to relax mind and body, beginning with the muscles of the toes and working up to those of the scalp. Consciously relaxing, letting go all holds, one after the other, finally making the mind a blank, or blanker than usual. I had worked my way up to the arms, and had just made my hands and forearms utterly inert, and there was what might be called, and indeed must be called, for there is no other description, ghastly cry. And the ghastly cry was uttered within the room. It was something between a moan, a wail, and a scream. I struck a match. It broke, fell onto the bedclothes and went out. And in a brief half-second of light, I saw what again might be called, indeed must be called, for there is no other description, something white. Ghostly figure crossed the room. I struck another match, pulled up the mosquito curtain with a great air of resolution and determination to look into the matter and do something, only to discover that there was no matter in which to look, and nothing to be done. There was no sound in the room, and certainly there was no something white. "And this is where another little drink wouldn't do us any harm," said I. In point of fact, it had no opportunity to do any harm or any good, for I had nothing to drink save a little soda water in the bottle left by my jungle boy. There was not even the Nam Ton porous clay with a tin cup inverted over its neck, usually to be found in dak bungalows, and had there been one, I should have hesitated to drink from it. Why, it is difficult to say. What is the difference between germ-infested water brought straight from the nearest Huey or pond to the bungalow and water of the native-owned soda water shop? Of the two, perhaps the soda water is the more dangerous, as its inhabitant microbes must be in a higher state of stimulation and activity, not to mention the mud and other filth encrusted in the neck of the soda water bottle. And having decided, I drank the soda water and lay down, after noting that, according to my watch, the night was still young, the hour being but 2 o'clock. Well, plenty of time for plenty of doings. Soon I fell asleep, even as do men who await the dawn firing party or the jail officials who come in to lead them to the scaffold, in that cheery frame of mind. Anyhow, I must have slept, because undoubtedly I was awakened. How much of what I experienced in the act of awakening was dream, how much imagination, and how much an utterly unreal reality, I don't know. But I do know that from a dream or from dreamless sleep, I awoke to the knowledge that there was a party in progress in the room. I must have been in the act of opening my eyes as I saw lights, the forms of men, heard speech and laughter. And what is more, noticed that it was slurred speech and over-noisy laughter. Also certain was I of this, that in the moment of sitting up and going to raise my mosquito curtain once more, the feeling uppermost in my mind was one of indignation. What right had these fellows to come carousing and binging in my room at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning? The most disgusting exhibition of caddish ill manners, and I threw up the curtain, prepared to speak my mind to that effect. Of course, there were no bright lights, there was no sound of revelry by night, but there was... They were trooping down the steps from the veranda to the garden, and as for a second I listened, now terrified rather than indignant. I knew that the merry party, instead of spreading itself over the garden with joyous whoops, drunken shouts, and alcoholic song, turned in under the bungalow among the tiangs, the great pillars of Merbau wood that supported the house. Distinctly I heard them. Distinctly I heard a crash, as of something heavy overturned. Distinctly I heard shouts and cries, which were not merry nor amusing. And finally a sound such as I hope never to hear again. Those who have heard the scream of a wounded horse will have some idea of the blood-curdling horror of that dreadful cry. Clear-cut, shocking shriek. It seemed to freeze the marrow in my bones and cause the hair of my head to stand on end. I had had enough. Getting out of bed and pulling on my boots, I lit the Hitchcock lamp, turned it up until its flame was as high as it would go, and was thankful for its steady brilliance, and the fact that it needed neither globe nor chimney, which might have blackened and broken and obscured the light. And holding high my lamp, I crossed the veranda, descended the steps, and boldly, yes, boldly, I plunged into the midst of whatever might be happening in the pillared gloom of the dreadful place beneath the bungalow. For it was dreadful. Not because of anything that was there, but because there was nothing there. No sign or sound of human being, animal, ghost, or spirit briefly incarnate. Save for the fact that it had no outer walls. The place was like a crypt. The big baulks of timber that supported the house, suggesting Norman pillars of stone several feet above my head, were the boards of the floor of the room from which I had just come. Beneath my feet was what had been hard-beaten earth, now in parts thinly covered by sickly weeds. No sign whatsoever of human visitation or occupation was there, save the collapsed timbers of what had been a big packing case. I was defeated, and promptly and willingly admitting defeat, fled from the place, mounted the steps, and re-entered my bed drawing room. And compared with the cellar-like place beneath the house, this horrible and haunted room seemed almost attractive, for inimical as was its atmosphere, it was not as fear-compelling as the other. Here above I felt fear. There below I felt a horror and terrible fearful beyond fear. I returned to bed, somnolent, and an attitude of defenceless acquiescence were out of the question, and I began to dress, involuntarily glancing over my shoulder, swiftly turning about to see what was behind me as I did so. And on this occasion, as not infrequently before, I was glad that I was an extremely temperate person, and that for me alcohol has no attraction. Incidentally, I really do not make this idiosyncrasy a cause for any self-approval. If I liked alcohol, I should drink it. I was glad because all that I had heard and the little I had seen really had been heard and seen. Well, there was no question of it. It was no alcohol-induced or drug-begotten fantasy. I had heard sounds when wide awake, as widely awake as I was now, doing up my buttons. True, I had wakened suddenly to see lights and hear sounds that might have been part of a dream, but I felt absolutely convinced that they had also been part of waking experience. Well, there are more things in heaven and earth. And whether I had been imagining things, dreaming dreams and seeing visions or not, one thing was certain. Nothing on earth, absolutely nothing, would induce me to spend another night in this place. Nay, nor another hour more than was necessary for my getting away from it. Next night I camped in the jungle, a most unpleasant night of wind and rain, and conditions that defeated even my accomplished Lao cook and jungle boy. A night that should have been memorable for its acute and complicated discomfort, but which, in point of fact, is memorable for its sweet peacefulness. A sweetness unsoured by cold driving rain and devilish plucking wind. A peace unbroken by the heaviest crashes of violent thunderstorms. Sweetness and peace, because this was the jungle, and not that fear-stricken, horror-infested bungalow. What were tigers, leopards, king cobras, scorpions, leeches, and the greatest of these is leeches, compared with one sound, one sight in that house of dread? The following night, I slept in a wat. We reached it at sundown, and it had an air of solid comfort, very reassuring to me after what I had been through. It was but a small wat, situated at the end of a green path which led to it from the road, a distance of about 200 yards. Its outer court, or hall, of stone was clean, and had a well-cared-for air about it. This outer hall had no walls, and its stone roof was supported on 4 heavy stone pillars. Near the entrance was an ancient sacred bow tree, whose branches were so heavy that each one had to be supported by a pole resting on the earth. The wat was empty, save for one pugni in a yellow robe, who was chanting before the stone image of Buddha, and he took no notice of me, until, presently departing, he gave me the usual greeting of Sabaga, are you well? To which I answered the usual Sabai, quite well. In front of the enormous effigy of the Buddha were arranged the heterogeneous collection of offerings, which are usually to be found in these wats, and which never cease to astonish one, by reason of their strange variety. There were stone jam jars containing dead flowers, cheap alarm clocks, such as are found in the village shops in England, bunches of dry flowers, brightly coloured feathers, celluloid or glass balls, bits of coloured china, tin and enamel mugs. There were also numerous candles, stuck in the melted wax of others, long since burnt out. These candles are only lit at festival times, when the villagers come to make their offerings. Here, in this place, was peace, for over it brooded the spirit of the Buddha, beneficent, well-wishing, and the pious founder of the temple had been one who fain would acquire merit. In it I slept peacefully. On the next day, my boy, leading our little party, suddenly turned aside and took a path even narrower and fainter than that on which we were. Some little distance down this path was a bamboo thang, or sala, built in a clearing in the jungle. It is not unusual to find these shelters in various parts of the dense forests. They are quite unfurnished and empty, and may be used by any passing traveller who happens to know where they are situated. The walls and floor are made of split bamboo. While perfectly strong and adequate, the bamboo floor is apt to be rather disconcerting when one walks on one of them for the first time, for it springs up and down with every movement, and it is difficult to keep one's balance until one becomes accustomed to the feeling of walking on springs. This particular palm was very charmingly situated. Behind it rose a steep hillside, covered with small teak trees, which were in flower. There were also many shrubs with leaves of various shades of red and gold. In front of the palm was the clearing, beyond which were the tall trees of the forest, and growing up one side of the shelter itself was a thick bush of the pale pink Honolulu creeper, which someone had, some time or other, planted there. Here again I slept in peace, and on the following night reached the house of an American medical missionary. The Reverend Dr. Gates proved to be a most interesting man, the soul of hospitality. As unlike the missionary of nitwit fiction as a man could be, and most definitely a doctor, an ethnologist, botanist, zoologist, and general scientist, long before he was a parson. When purely for the sake of making conversation, a thing that at first has to be made when one meets a man who has not spoken his own language for months or years, I somewhat fatuously asked him if he had made many converts. He somewhat disconcertingly replied, "Converts to what?" and later admitted modestly that he had possibly converted a few wild was to tameness, a few Karens, and possibly one or two arboreal moes to elementary ideas of hygiene and handicraft. Anyhow, shy jungle folk came to him with their wives and other troubles, realizing that his methods of accouchement were better than those of their own witch doctors, who did not invariably get the best results from their method of roasting the expectant mother before a large fire in the jungle. After an excellent dinner that night, we settled down to talk, and, having lived long enough to know when the most successful conversationalist is he who uses his ears far more than his mouth, I got the doctor to tell me of his life work. And when the good doctor at length fell silent, after apologizing for having talked so much, and I had told him it was the best talk I had had for years, I introduced the subject that even so was uppermost in my mind. "Do you believe in ghosts, doctor?" I asked, as he stuffed his pipe. "Ghosts?" he laughed. "Depends entirely on what you mean by ghosts. I haven't an unshakable belief in the chain-rattling figure of the wicked Sir Giles who crosses the moonlit hall at midnight, nor much in the grey lady who is discovered sitting in costume in the music room at sunset on St. John's Eve. Why? Do you believe in ghosts?" "Depends entirely on what you mean by ghosts," I smiled. "I didn't believe in any sort or kind of ghost until last Monday night. Now I may have to do so." "Last Monday night, let's see, 4 marches back." "Ah, that means the abandoned bungalow just over the border, the one they tried to turn into a rest house. Stayed a night there, did you? What happened?" "Oh, a lot of funny things. Well, first of all, a ghost walked up and down the room in the silence and the darkness, breaking the stillness of the night by causing the boards to creak beneath his weight." "The weight of a ghost," smiled the doctor. "Weight or something," I said. "Well, deal with that first. Suppose a leopard came in and padded to the end of the room and back, looking for your dog, as they do. I should have smelt it. Probably. I should have heard its claws on the boards." "One doesn't, in point of fact," said the doctor. And from the way in which he spoke, he had evidently been in the same room with the leopard and darkness by night. "Anyway, we needn't go as far as that. The boards creaked and groaned as the temperature fell. Or, more likely still, as they imperceptibly moved back into place after your weight had rested on them. I nodded. Pass up. Next thing. Something, probably not a leopard, came and played the piano. Recognized the tune? No, there was no tune. It was a God Almighty, excuse me, crash, as though some giant had suddenly struck every key in 3 octaves simultaneously, and so hard that some of the wires broke. Yes, very disturbing, in the middle of the night, and admittedly not a leopard. I'll tell you what happened. Oh, thank you, said I, perhaps a shade, skeptically. An iguana fell from a horizontal roof beam, full length, onto, and as it happened, exactly parallel to the keyboard. Yes, I admitted. That would serve. Do iguanas get up in the roof? I asked. Not that I know of, admitted Dr. Gates, frankly. But there's a mighty big lizard. They call it the gull up here. What, the Siamese toctor? I asked. A bit bigger, said Gates. Though I don't know that I've ever seen one that would cover 3 octaves on the piano. The snake could, of course, he added. Yes, I mused. But it would be funny if a snake fell rigid in a straight line like that, wouldn't it? Extremely funny, except for the person who was there listening to it, admitted Gates. But if a big snake fell 10 or 15 feet onto a keyboard of a piano, there would be some noise. Or I'll tell you what it might have been, he continued. Not an iguana, but an ichneumon. Civet cat, said I, proud of my worldly knowledge. Yes, same sort of thing. Now, they do inhabit roofs, and they are apt to drop most suddenly and somewhat alarmingly from the roof to the floor. It might have been an ichneumon. I had a nice little chap here, tame as a cat. Used to worry my dog frightfully, although I had taught him to accept the hitherto wild jungle beast as a house companion. Trix was a big Airedale, stood about 1.5 feet high, and the civet cat, Joe, used to stalk him. As Trix walked past its hiding place, Joe would run out, climb onto Trix's hind leg, run up and along the dog's back, and perch on his head just above his nose. I'm afraid it was the bane of poor Trix's life, but he put up with it very patiently. Well, iguana, go, toctor, or ichneumon for the piano playing, pass up. By the way, the piano was played twice. Yes, that was the iguana, or gull, scrambling off the piano after resting, a bit winded from his fall, of course. Well, the next thing was an eerie, shudder-making cry in the room, and an indisputable glimpse of the something white of ghostly fiction. This was fact. Let's see, pondered the doctor. Yes, I think we can dispose of that. There's a very large white owl in these parts, whose nocturnal habits are not blameless. He's quite equal to a sudden swoop right through your bungalow, in at the back and out at the front, uttering a shriek to curdle your blood as he does so. Is he intentionally offensive? No, it's, this is the house that Jack built sort of a sequence. Tiny insects such as mosquitoes and moths fly about. Bats come in and catch the flying insects, and the huge white owl comes in to catch the bats. That was your ghost. I nodded. Pass up. He's rather an interesting chap, that bird. Biggest owl in the world, and the natives always attribute its cry to a peh, and compare the owl to the peh nork. When they hear it, they hurry inside their huts, and if possible, shut themselves in. And curiously enough, the cicadas seem to share their fear or dislike, for they always cease their shrilling, and the jungle becomes comparatively silent for some time after the cry has been heard. Some people think the cicadas shut up because they know that the owl eats them, and they realize that their natural enemy is near at hand. Anything else? Anything. I smiled. These were only hors d'oeuvres variés. Yes, there was something else. I fell asleep. A fact that I frankly admit, and I woke from a dream. Another fact that I frankly admit, and the dream continued for a few seconds, so to speak, as I awoke. And a rowdy party that was in my dream was continued in my room. I am sure that for a few seconds, or perhaps for part of 1 second, I was literally wide awake to the fact that this party was going on. And then, in quiet gates, I found that the room was in darkness and that the party was trooping down the steps and going in under the bungalow. Dr. Gates eyed me steadily. "Explanations, please?" I smiled. "Ah, now you're asking for something," was the quiet reply. "Haven't you something else to tell me?" "Well, only that I lit my lamp, got up, pulled on my boots, and went down to investigate." "Good for you," said Gates. "I know exactly how you felt. But what I meant was, haven't you something else to tell me about the party?" "No. No." "Oh, yes, of course." Above the laughter and the voices, I distinctly heard a crash. Sort of noise made by an Elmira falling down on its face. "Exactly. Yes, yes." And then a most appalling scream. The most utterly dreadful sound I've ever heard in my life. "Yes," agreed Dr. Gates. And I say agreed advisedly, for obviously he had been expecting me to say just what I had said. I might, of course, produce the paynock to account for the scream, but I won't. "What is it? Why not?" I asked. "What is it? The paynock is probably the bird I mentioned just now. It must be a bird. Nobody has seen it, but all jungle dwellers have heard it. I rank myself as a jungle dweller, and I have heard it. Like the natives themselves. I would pay down quite a perceptible little sum in hard cash rather than hear it again. And I'd travel a mighty long way round a place where it was likely to be heard. And the reason why I won't blame the noise you heard on the paynock is because it wasn't made by one." "By what was it made, then?" "Now, my friend, you are asking another question. I will reply with a story. A story that I think will answer that question. Also answer the first one of the series. And that was, do you believe in ghosts?" Geoffrey Walsh Curnock built that bungalow and laid out that plantation in that particular spot because, amongst other considerations, climate, soil, water, labor, and so on, it was in what he considered the unadministered territory. This mission is, of course, undeniably an unadministered territory, and at the moment you are neither in China nor Burma, neither in Siam nor Cambodia. You are nowhere, in fact. Not on any map, at least. And Geoffrey had the idea that if he made his plantation and built his bungalow where he did, he'd be free. No one would have any right to interfere with him. He was a curious chap, and that was one of his idiosyncrasies. Freedom. As if anyone is free anywhere. However, I was glad enough when he came up this way, for it made my nearest neighbor only 60 miles away. What one might call quite near. One could have a monthly chat with a fellow white man. We got along famously, with our dozen talks a year. And though we didn't see eye to eye on many things, we had a mutual respect, and the bond of total dissimilarity. He did me a lot of good, broadened my outlook, and made me more tolerant, and I tried to do him a bit of good, so far as that was possible, without being offensive. Though I must admit it ended in my insisting on his coming and seeing me here instead of my going there, for I really am an awfully poor hand at orgy making. I don't play cards, I don't drink, and I don't like being a wet blanket. And whenever Jeffrey sent a messenger over, inviting me to his place for the first Saturday of the month, I knew what it meant. It meant, among other things, a wild party. For his monthly feasts became famous, and forest officers and young teak men, wandering prospectors who had no idea that anybody who went off the beaten track was likely to stumble over large rubies, ingots of silver or lumps of jade, elephant hunters, and occasionally some of those wonderful people who catch large, free, wild beasts alive and put them in little iron cages, were apt to be among his guests. Anyhow, party, large or small, there always was on the first Saturday in the month at Walsh Canuck's place. Of course it was famous, apart from its hospitality, by reason of its being unique. Positively the only plantation in this part of the world, the only place for hundreds of miles where a white man, or any other man, tried to grow kapok, tea, and rubber. Naturally, it has all gone back to jungle now. And I doubt whether any of it would have done much good, unless possibly it was the kapok, although I have an idea that there was more in and behind Walsh Canuck than met the eye. The doctor fell silent as he eased the tobacco in his pipe, and looked extremely thoughtful. "In what way?" I asked. "I don't know. It was no more than wild theory on my own part, but it was such an unlikely place for such an unlikely man that there must have been more to it than met the eye. I don't know. Oil, rubies, jade, silver, a consular official watching Chinese encroachment from the north, and then again it might just have been agoraphobia. Just his idiosyncratic love of solitude. He's yearning to escape from his fellow man. And yet, there were wild parties. I don't know. Well, one Friday afternoon, the day before one of the monthly gatherings of half a score of people who came from all over half a score of thousand square miles, Jeffrey Walsh Canuck was sitting on the veranda of that bungalow having tea when there came along the track leading to the bungalow a party of Kamu junglemen, personally conducting a gigantic python. They do, you know, in the most extraordinary manner. Something like a couple of agricultural laborers leading a bull at home. When he thinks he'll charge to the right, the man on the left pulls him back. And when he thinks he'll charge to the left, the man on the right pulls him back. And if he thinks he'll bolt straight ahead, they both pull him back. Same with the python. These folk tie a rattan rope round his neck, and a band of them gets at each end of it, and they lead him along. If he won't go straight ahead, they drag him. If he goes too fast, they put the brake on. If he wants to go left or right, they do exactly as the bull leaders do. And perhaps you are wondering why they took the trouble to bring this great brute over 25 feet long and as thick as a man's thigh to call on Walsh Canuck. It was because he was assembling specimens of the fauna of this part of the world to give, or possibly to sell, to a man who was making a collection for the New York Museum of Natural History. So he extended a cordial welcome to what was the very finest specimen of snake he had ever seen. The next problem was how to house it worthily and safely until Brooke came for it. Suddenly he remembered a packing case in which his piano had arrived. Incidentally, just fancy a man going to the expense and trouble of getting a piano up here. How on earth did he do it? I asked. Well, I should imagine every form of known transport was used between the warehouse in Bangkok and that bungalow. Train, sampan, elephant, bullock cart, and mostly human beast of burden. That piano must have come on men's heads through swamp and jungle, over hill track and forest path, like a stag beetle carried by ants. Well, into the piano packing case, without apology or ceremony, went the huge python. A big stone was placed on the lid. Kamu coolies then being handsomely rewarded with a 5 satang piece, about a penny each. Jeffrey returned to his tea. Nor, we may imagine, did he give the snake another thought until at the height of the party, next night, when the champagne dinner finished, It was always champagne for the guests at Jeffrey's monthly party, and the brandy and soda flowing. The devil put it into somebody's mouth to say, "If you drink much more, Jeff, you'll be seeing snakes." They had been amusing themselves by trying to snuff a burning candle standing on the veranda rail at 20 paces, with revolvers fired from the back of the room, when Walsh Curnock, who had been very successful, asked if anyone would let him shoot the candle off the top of his head, you know, like William Tell in The Apple. There was an Austrian there, a queer chap with a highly polished bald head. He was a man who was trying to grow cotton 100 miles east of Walsh Koenig's place, and Jeffrey particularly wanted to drop some hot wax on his bald cranium, stick the candle in it, light it, and snuff the flame at 20 paces. But the Austrian, though otherwise a sensible man, objected. "No, you're drunk, Jeff," said he. "If you drink much more, you'll be seeing snakes in a minute." And that was what reminded him. "Snakes!" he cried. "Adam and Eve, I'll show you a snake. I've got the very one that escaped from the Garden of Eden downstairs. Come and have a look." And picking up the candle and telling someone else to bring the lamp, he led the way down those steps, and they all trooped in under the bungalow. "Here, catch hold of this," he said to somebody, gave him the candle, went to pull the big stone off the top of the packing case, and overturned the whole thing. There was a crash as it went over, and the stone and lid fell away, releasing the enormous python. Before that lot of drunken and half-drunken and wine-excited young men knew it, that 25 feet of immeasurable deadly strength was among them. The man holding the lamp, backing away, fell over the stone, dropping the lamp as he did so. The lamp went out. The man who held the candle bled for his life. And as the rest turned, shouting, scrambling, stumbling in the pitch darkness, bumping into the Tiangs, they heard a scream that curdled their blood. It was one of them who told me all this, and I shall never forget the phrase he used. It was a shrieking scream of agony and fear. It seemed to rend the very fabric of the night with a gigantic tearing sound that pierced one's eardrums. He wasn't an Englishman, as you may imagine. The first man who returned with a light held above his head saw Jeffrey Walsh Curnock, bound to one of the 12-foot Tiangs by a gigantic rope, a living rope, the python, whose open mouth and coldly glaring eyes hovered a few inches from those of its victim, its crushed and mangled victim, in whose body every single bone was broken a dozen times. Yes, I heard every detail of the whole affair from an eyewitness, the man who saw him in the serpent's coils. He came straight here, just as quickly as he could travel him, and I had to nurse him for quite a while before he was fit to take up life again. He sat a while in silence. "Before I leave this place, if I ever do," said Dr. Gates, "I shall come to believe that I too was an eyewitness, instead of only an ear witness of what happened that night." "A what?" "An ear witness, like yourself. The night I slept there, I heard exactly what you did. I don't mean the creakings of the dry floorboards, nor the falling of the lizard onto the piano, and the hooting of the owl, but the laughter, the descent to the place beneath, the brief hubbub, and then the cry." "Do we believe in ghosts, you and I, Doctor?" I asked. No, of course not. Aren't we rational, sensible men? We each dreamed a dream, a nightmare rather, and were wakened by the scream of the Paynock. Quite so, I agreed. Obviously. But tell me, what was your chief essential fundamental sensation? Your real mental reaction to that bungalow? Fear. Soul-shaking, mind-enfeebling, body-devitalizing fear, he replied. Mine too, I admitted. There, I really knew fear. Today's story was Fear by P.C. Wren. It was read by Jasper Lestrange. I hope you enjoyed it, and until next time, sweet dreams.